All right, so tonight, the title of the class is Yom Yerushalayim, bringing Hashem Shechina into the camp. Okay, so this Thursday night into Friday is Yom Yerushalayim. Who can tell me what Yom Yerushalayim commemorates? Anybody got any ideas? What does Yom Yerushalayim commemorate?
Is it the liberation of Jerusalem during the Six Day War or the Yom Kippur War?
Shmuel, that is correct. It is the liberation of Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, the Har HaBayit, and during the 6 Day War that occurred on, they took over the entire city of Jerusalem on June 7th, 1967, during the 67 War. So we're going to get into that. And we're going to connect it to the Parsha's Bamidbar. So we're going to try to accomplish all these goals in the 1 hour that we have together. So let's get on to it. So I'm going to now share screen for those. I will just try to describe what we're going to see for those who cannot see it. Okay. So let's just see. Did everybody see the picture there? In your own words, what is those three soldiers? What does that represent to you? Without go, I'll give the backstory. What do those three pictures? What do the three pictures represent to you? The three guys.
The top picture would be the soldiers, I guess as they were walking into the old city or walking to the Kotel, before or just as they were taking it over. And the bottom picture is many, many, many years later, those same three soldiers looking at the Kotel as it's been in Jewish hands since.
Correct. So this whole thing was done, 3 years ago. We're coming up to the 53rd Yom Yerushalayim, and this picture is the this is called the David Rubinger photograph of three paratroops standing in silent awe in front of the recaptured Western Wall after the Battle of Jerusalem in 1967, has become the defining image of one of the most significant moments in Israel's history. This was taken 3 years ago, with the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War approaching. Tzion Kara Senti, Chaim Oshri, and Dr. Yitzhak Yifat returned to the old city this week to remember the moment. So they had the same three guys standing in the same location, looking up at the sort of recreating the picture 50 years later. Okay. So that's just that was a quintessential moment, and that really I want to now share with you. I'm going to focus your attention on this. These were members of the 55th paratrooper brigade of the IDF. They were Israel's very best, who were sent into on the on just to give you a little chronology. The 6 Day War started on a Monday morning, 7:45, when 207 French Mirage fighter pilots went about 50 feet above the Mediterranean, snuck down to the eight Egyptian airports, demolished them, had air superiority, then went on to the Jordanian airfields and then the Syrian airfields, and within 1 day had complete air superiority, which of course gave them Israel the advantage to have the success they did. Now, interesting fact, there was never they made a plan to knock out the Egyptian air force and the Jordanian and the Syrian. They had no plan to recapture the old city of Jerusalem. It wasn't because it was never even a fantasy of theirs that they'd be able to do that. because they lost so when they were fighting in 1948, they lost so bitterly they just gave up as even a possibility. So when Achim Begin went to Moshe Dayan, who was then the Minister of Defense, said, "We got to take Jerusalem. The time is now. We're winning." This was on Wednesday. So this is on the day two. So you have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. They started fighting Tuesday night. They had the famous Battle of Ammunition Hill, which MG Heritage Trip actually went to. It's one of the big places in Jerusalem. And then Wednesday morning, they go in, and now they go into, we'll see some footage, of course. They go in via Lion's Gate, and they had a fierce battle. One day, a battle of Wednesday, and by Wednesday afternoon, the famous statement from Commander Mota Gur, Har Habayit Biyadenu, the Temple Mount is in our hands. So I'm going to go to the video, and I'm focusing on one person, one of the paratroopers, which is Rabbi Yoel Binun, which you may not have heard of, but I'm going to give you some background. So let's go to the video. It's in Hebrew, but there are English subtitles for those people who are watching. Get the benefit. If you're on the phone, unless your Hebrew is good, I'll summarize afterwards. Here we go. Hold on 1 second. Bear with me for a second. Here we go. Share this. I always forget to share the sound.
הלחימה הייתה קשה מאוד יום אחד. ביום שפרצנו לכאן עד שהגענו לרוקפלר. הלחימה הייתה קשה מאוד בגלל שלא היה זמן להכין אותה. והיו הרבה טעויות. אבל ביום השני כבר כמעט לא הייתה לחימה. אחרי שהקפנו את העיר העתיקה מסביב, המפקד הירדני בתוך העיר העתיקה, הוא לא רצה להילחם עד האיש האחרון, והוא ביקש אישור לצאת מהעיר. כששאל אותי המפקד שלי, כשהיינו בהר הבית, הוא שאל אותי, יואל, מה אתה אומר עכשיו? אמרתי לו, 2,000 שנה נגמרו. הכוונה ל-2,000 שנה שעם ישראל היה בגולה, ונרדף ומונה ואנטישמיות, 2,000 שנה נגמרו. הרגשתי את ההיסטוריה מתרחשת לנגד עיניי. הייתה הרגשה של משהו משמיים. וככה הרגשה שלי עד היום. לשפה של המוסלמים היא שפה דתית, שברגע שהמוסלמים, מנהיגי הדת, יבינו שזה מעלה, ישראל זה בני ישראל שאללה בחר בהם ורוצה בהם ומחזיר אותם הביתה. וכשהם יבינו את זה, יהיה שלום פה ויהיה שלום בכל העולם.
אוקיי. Okay. A dramatic declaration. Okay, so first of all, who could summarize what did Rabbi Yoel Binun say about his experience being one of the paratroopers that took the Ir HaTikah, the old city, liberated the old city, took the Temple Mount? What was his? How would you describe his experience?
I think it was a very big inflection point, not just for him personally, but for Jewish people generally. He described how we've been prosecuted, treated unfairly, belligerent, and now it was sort of like this turning point in all of Jewish history.
Right. And he described it. He felt this was that moment was, as he said, min hashamayim. He felt this was, as a soldier, and he says there were a lot of mistakes because they weren't prepared for it. What he really saying, there were a lot of guys that died because they were in the very narrow streets of the old city, which those who've been to the old city know, there were Jordanian sharpshooters that picked away a lot of the guys. A lot of guys died, tragically. So, but he felt it was, they only fought one day, Wednesday, and then by Wednesday, then Thursday, done. By Wednesday afternoon was done, and it was just a remarkable experience. So, this, but this moment really changed. He felt that, and of course, he goes a step further. He says, if the Muslims worldwide will realize that Allah, not God, but Allah has brought His people back to the land, there'll be peace in the world. So that's his take on the experience. Okay. Does anybody know who Yoel Binun is? Have you heard that name before? He's not famous in America. He's only famous in Israel. So I'm just going to share just give you a short bio, just to give you a little sense. I'll have somebody read it. All right. All right, Shmuel Bavakasha, can you read it out loud? Read the bio.
Yeah. Dr. Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun is one of the founders of Yeshiva Har Etzion. He received his rabbinic training at Yeshiva Merkaz Harav, thank you. And his PhD from Hebrew University. In 1986, he established Herzl College for training Jewish studies teachers, especially in biblical instruction. Between 2000 and 2006, he served as the Rosh HaYeshiva of Yeshivat HaKibbutz HaDati.
Yep.
In Ein Zerim.
Yep.
He's viewed as the founder of the modern-day Tanakh revolution. One example is the Herzl College-sponsored week-long Tanakh conference, which was attended by 8,000 people annually.
Yes.
Or is attended.
Is attended by 8,000 people annually.
Thank you. This has inspired another Tanakh conference to be run in Israel at other yeshivot and institutions.
Yeah, so let me show you a quick video component just to keep... In other words, and then I'm going to explain to you what the Tanakh revolution is all about. Okay, so let me just show you... so you see over here, this is how to sign up. This is on the Herzog College website called Yemeyum B'Tanakh, and it's run during the 9 days, which of course not such a time to, you know, not such a pleasant time. But meanwhile, the yeshivot and the people come in from all over, and they have, let's say, you know, you can go, there's like 30 lectures. They have in English, obviously in Hebrew, Spanish, for a lot of, Spanish speaking, French. So they have shiurim, you know, high-level Tanakh shiurim on a variety of levels. Now, not only that, they started it, but there are other yeshivos that, you know, well, we have great educators. Let's do our own Tanakh. Let's do our own 3-day Tanakh thing. Rabbi Menachem Liedtag is one of the lead, you know, those who are at MJE fellowship, senior fellowship, have had Rabbi Liedtag. He is one of the speakers, gives shiurim at the college. Not only that, non-Orthodox, but the National Library in Israel just also started Tanakh days, and look who the audience is. I'll show a short clip. Take a look at the audience. Let me make sure you get the volume on this. Sorry. We got the share screen. Good. Here we go. Hold on. You don't see the video?
No, the sound, but no video.
Okay, so I apologize for that. Let me try this. Do you see the video now?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. All right. It's from the National Museum in Israel. So it's trying to deal with secular Jews. Some religious, some not religious. Look, you see people there with kippot, not kippot, religious, not religious.
We've ללמוד ולשנות, להגות וללבן, להעמיק חקור בפסוקים ובמילים. כאן, כשאנו מוקפים באוצרות הספרייה ומכמניה, המקום אליו נאספים אוצרות הרוח של העם היהודי והחברה הישראלית.
Well, this is the education minister Naftali Bennett. All right, so you get a sense. So what's cool about that is that the Tanakh Revolution, just to give you a sense, I know there's no subtitles, but just I just want to give you, but you saw the audience. What did you see about the audience? You should have caught that.
It was a mix of dati and non-dati.
Correct. You had a woman with a haircut, you know, dressed tzniut, with a head, with a haircut, her hair covered, next to a woman with a sleeveless shirt, and they're all in a Tanakh shir. Okay. So let me explain a little bit about, I just want to explain a little bit about this Tanakh Revolution business, so you'll get a little flavor. But the truth is, who here has, I mean, I know Adrian, and I know Shana, Suzanne, have you heard Rabbi Menachem Liebtag? Okay. Also, maybe Sean, and I think Julie. So he is also a major player. What is the Tanakh Revolution was? So basically, in this Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, when he started Yeshiva Har Tzion, which for some of you actually, we went in the building, but that's where Rabbi Avi Heller was in Yeshiva. That's where my son, my father went there as well when he retired. You've heard Rabbi Moshe Tarragon when we were in Israel. So it's a fantastic yeshiva, but what's unique about it is that they decided, let's learn Tanakh, not just Chumash, but Tanakh, the entire Bible, in a rigorous way, as in the same level that yeshivot historically have given that level of emphasis to Gemara. So that's a new thing, because in a traditional yeshiva, Gemara and Halacha gets a lot of emphasis, a lot of intellectual umph, and Tanakh, not so much. So, and not only that, in adding archaeology, bringing in academic studies, and bringing in various other external elements, not just the traditional sources, is really the mark of the Tanakh Revolution. And part of the Tanakh, those conferences, they have Tanakh Tiulim, which of course those who went with Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, we had fun. We actually, you go to a place where the event in Tanakh happened, and you learn about it where it occurred. So it's a very cool thing. So they run those as well. So that's something which, and they have them also in English. So if you they're going to be doing in Israel. Israel's starting to open up. So if you want to go to Israel and go to the Tanakh conference and just have everything in English, you most certainly can. Okay, we continue. All right. Now let's transition to the Parsha. Okay. Everybody see the info? I'm going to now share the infographic. Always got to have an infographic. Everybody see the infographic? All right. Could somebody describe the image for those people who do not have a video, who can see? Who wants to give a description? Adrian, give us a shot. What is being described there?
This is the temple, the Beis Hamikdash.
Not exactly.
Tabernacle.
What do they call that What do they call that in the desert?
The Mishkan,
the tabernacle, which means that it's mobile. It folds up and it moves. So prior to this part, 1 year in, how did the Jews congregate in the desert from leaving Egypt until Har Sinai, and then a year after, For the first year after leaving Egypt, how did the Jews congregate?
So, and actually, you know, I thought it was the temple because I think the temple was similar.
The temple is the Mikdash, the temple built by Shlomo, King Solomon, in Jerusalem, was taking the Mishkan, which was a temporary tent situation, and making it a permanent building. The one, of course, is based upon the other. They have the same things in it. So it's 100% connected. 100%. One's a model of the other. Mishkan came first. But just simply, I'm going to pick out Sean. Sean, can you hear me, Sean?
I hear you.
Good. How did the Jews, in the first year after leaving Egypt, how did the Jews encamp?
They had 12 tribes.
They had 12 tribes, yeah. How did they camp?
Each one had a different sort of place.
No. That's in this week's Parsha. But beforehand, basically, you lived in a tent, very simply, wherever you wanted. Let's say Adrian was good friends with Shmuel, so you'd put your tents together. And they also like Sean, so Sean lived there. And then Suzanne, she was nearby, and Shane and everybody. Everybody could be based upon where you are socially, okay? And then there was a major shift that happened in the sixth parsha, the beginning of the first chapter of Bamidbar. Let's go to somebody reading. All right, let me call upon Shayna. Okay, read this. Take us into chapter 2. Chapter 1 has the census, and chapter 2 has the organizing of the camp. Read it out there, Shayna.
Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, "The Israelites shall camp with each person near the banner having his paternal family's insignia. They shall camp at a specified distance around the communion tent."
What is a communion tent in Hebrew?
Is that the Mishkan?
That is the Mishkan. So everybody now has to camp near a banner, as a flag, based upon what? What's the grouping? Who would you have to have your tent near?
In your family.
Your family. And then all the families had to have, let's go on, Pasuk, go on the next Pasuk.
"Camping to the east, the direction of sunrise, shall be the divisions under the banner of Yehuda. The leader of Yehuda's descendants was Nachshon, son of Aminadab. The tally of his division was 74,600. Camping near him shall be the tribe of Issachar, and the leader of Issachar's descendants was Netanel, son of Suar. The tally of his division was 54,400. With them shall be the tribe of Zebulun, and the leader of Zebulun's descendants was Eliab, son of Chelon. The tally of his division was 57,400. The entire tally for the divisions in Yehuda's camp was thus 186,400.
Okay, good.
They shall go first."
Correct, excellent. So here's the deal. So you have, let's look at the levels of, I'm going to go back up to the infographic, that let's say we have Yehuda. So you have Yehuda, and that Zebulun and Yisachar are on either side. And there, what are they, what unit, so you have the family unit, you have the tribal unit, and what other unit do you have?
The military unit. Is it the army unit?
Say it again?
The
yes.
Army
yes.
Unit, or just marching unit? In the translation, it said marching unit.
Correct. Yes. So therefore, they had, like you have, in a normal army, you have platoons, and then a larger group is a brigade, and then a larger one is a division. You know what I'm saying? So basically, the Jews got put into a army arrangement, which is families, tribe, and then among your division. And one, and who was the tribe of the first division? Who was the tip of the spear?
Yehuda.
he went first, and then followed by his two guys, other tribes, his sister tribes or brother tribes, I don't know what the exact term, Zebulun and Yisachar are the two tribes that went with that. Okay, so let's go back to the Psukim. Right? Okay. Is everybody clear upon that? I want to make sure everybody sees. So before there was, you basically, before you could camp wherever you want, and now you're being put in now, and what's the, Shmuel, what's in the center of the entire army camp?
Remains the Mishkan.
Okay. Who is around the Mishkan?
Aaron and Moses in the front, and then you have, I believe, the priestly ranks and the Levites around.
The Levites. So remember, there's only at this time, there's only four Kohanim. There's Aaron and Aaron. Yeah, Aaron and his
two sons.
Well, now he had four. He has down to two sons. So there's only three Kohanim right now. So the Kohanim is a little bit thin. But they got three families of Levium, Kahat, Gershon, and Merari, and they're around the Mishkan. They sort of protect the Mishkan. Okay, so let's keep on going. I'm not going to read everything. Now, we'll go to a series of questions here. Question number one. Suzanne, why does Hashem insist that the army organize the troops by tribes in a specific order? Why can't they all hang around their own friends? You're on mute.
In case there's trouble, this way they're organized, ready to go, I would think. It would be chaos if they were hanging around their friends.
Correct, because basically right now they're leaving the book of Bamidbar starts off, they've been at Mount Sinai for about a year. They had a couple of travails. They had the whole episode of the golden calf. They learned the Torah. They built a Mishkan. What are they now ready to do? What's the next step, Sean? What's the next step in their mission? What do they got to do? What do they got to accomplish?
Go into Israel and conquer it.
They got to go into Israel and conquer it. Is exactly correct. So therefore, you can't just walk into Israel any old way. You got to basically organize in a military fashion. You can't just, you know, because there are 31 tribes, clans in the land of Canaan that do not want you there. So you need to have to deal with war. Okay? So that's number one. Okay, great. We go on to the next question. All right. Let me ask somebody else. Julie. What is in the center of the camp?
The Beit HaMikdash.
Well, you can call it the Beit HaMikdash, but at this point, it's the precursor to the Beit HaMikdash called the Mishkan. Mishkan means tabernacle. It's the mobile sanctuary. It's designed, whatever they move, it can be put into boxes, folded up, packed, put on wagons, and it moves. Now, now, this is the key question to anybody. I'll throw this out to anybody. What does this placement say about the national priority given to the spiritual work done in the Mishkan? In other words, the fact that the Mishkan is in the center, what is significant about that? What does it teach us about what's occurring there in the Mishkan? What is the significance of that?
That all things revolve around the sanctity of Hashem.
Correct. And the service to Hashem that's occurring there, which is not personal but national, is really the main focus. Now, let me dissect that. What happens in the Ohel Moed? What happens in that sanctuary? You have a daily service that Aaron and his two sons would perform. What else? And I don't think in our Parsha class, we've not discussed this, but you guys do learn Torah outside of this class, so you might know it. What else occurred after Har Sinai in the Mishkan beyond the national service? A very important activity. I'll give you guys a hint. It involved only Moshe.
Prophecy?
Yes, God would speak to him, and it was perceived by him that God was talking, as it were, communicating to him from the Kruvim, from the on top of the holy of the Aaron, the holy box, the holy container, which had the luchot, and they had the Kruvim, the cherubim, with their wings covering the box, which had the Ten Commandments in it. And he would get Nevuah and other mitzvot, which would be told would be coming from there. So therefore, it was also a source of wisdom. Ultimately, in the Mishkan would also be, who would also be residing there at one point when they had it? Who else would be there? At least in the courtyard.
The Levites
are around there in honor guard, and they have certain. They also play the music, so they have a role. They're there as well, and they're in charge of packing up and taking down and packing up and moving it. They also the Sanhedrin. So at some point there was a Sanhedrin created, and they would gather in the temple in on the campus in they call the Lishkat HaGazit. But I don't know exactly where, but therefore there was another function that the Sanhedrin would be there discussing, learning on the general campus, or let's say in the courtyard of the Mishkan. So you had really three functions. You had God communicating to Moshe, you had teaching the Torah to the Sanhedrin, to what they call the elders, and the national service. So the reason that's in the center, that's sort of like the heart of the nation. You might even call it the soul of the nation. And the rest of the people function as the body of the nation. You know what I'm saying? You can use that metaphor. All right. Now, who surrounds the Mishkan? This is a quick review. Who surrounds them? I'll go back to the infographic. Who is in the first ring? There are two rings around the Mishkan. Who's ring one?
Immediately around the Mishkan was the Levim.
The Levim, the three families of the Levim, A, and then of course Moshe and Aaron in the front, okay, and then who's around that first circle?
The nine other tribes.
The rest of the tribes, which are actually 12 tribes. Levi's not counted.
Oh.
3, 6, 9, 12. Yes, Levi's not counted as the 12 tribes. Or you call the 12 tribes that Ephraim and Manasseh are counted as one. But you can count in two ways. Okay. All right, so it's called, or Yosef, because Yosef was the actual brother. Yeah, Ephraim and Manasseh are really the grandchildren. Okay. Now, let's keep on going. We're going to drive it back to Yom Yerushalayim. Okay. Now, so we have the Mishkan in the center, we have the Levim in the first thing, and then we have all the other Jews organized in a military fashion around that. Now, this division of labor, does that exist today? Does that division of labor within the Jewish people exist today?
I don't think so.
They have different... groups being called up for brachas, but that's not really
division of labor. Right, so Julie's correct. We still recognize the tribal distinction of Kohen and Levi. They're called up, but are the Kohanim and the Levim, who are then at that point the educators and those who did the national service, is that institution so functional in our day and age?
No.
Who really has taken their place?
The rabbis.
A rabbi functions, even though he may not be biologically a Kohen or a Levi, he functions as he's doing the Kohen Levi job post temple. And the rest of the people function to be able to ensure that there's a strong Jewish people. So there is that division of labor still exists. There's an education class who are involved in education and rabbinic leadership and Torah leadership. And then there's the people who engage with them, hopefully are being uplifted by them. Now, let's... Now, going back to that original picture tonight, I'm going to go back to the picture, take a look. I'm just going to... So what kind of Jews were these guys from the 55th Paratroop platoon or brigade? What kind of Jews did, what kind of role do they play? Where in the concentric circles are they, where are they, what role are they playing?
The tip of the spear, Yehuda.
Right. So that's actually excellent. Because they're not just fighting, or they're not just taking care of the military things. They are taking a leading role. They are, Shmuel said, the tip of the spear. They were trained as the paratroopers to literally go in with really no real plan. And not only that, they didn't have very good math. They had to literally improvise as they went in. And they did a phenomenal job. So they are the great warriors, the tip of the spear. Now, one of their comrades was Rabbi Yoel Binun. What role did he play? Is he the same? Is he the same as them, or is he different? What do you guys say?
I kind of want to say he's almost like a Sanhedrin type role.
Well, at that point, he was a soldier, but he was already a rabbi. So he's called a rabbi warrior. He's a blend of two things. He's playing both roles. So now, by the way, the same brigade, the 55th Paratroop Brigade, guess when they got called up again? Well, now they're going to be they were at that point in their late 20s. When were they called up again? This is Israeli history trivia question.
Yom Kippur War.
They played a very... Now, people do not remember this, but the Yom Kippur War was a disaster. 2,500 Israeli soldiers were killed. And initially, they were losing. And quite frankly, the elite 55th Brigade, 55th Paratroop Brigade, were critical at turning the whole thing around. Okay, so, but meanwhile, they're not young anymore. You know what I mean? You know, there's young when you're 22, and then when you're 28 to 32, you're called up, you got kids, you got a wife. You know what I mean? You're not, you know, by and large, these guys. And they had to, you know, they had a lot more to lose, and they were called up. And again, they came in, and they did a masterful job. So just this, it's worthwhile Googling the IDF 55th Paratrooper Grade, because they're just a phenomenal. Another reading, if you want a nice book, Yosef HaKlein Levi wrote a beautiful book marking seven of those paratroopers. The book is called Like Dreamers, and they represent sort of the seven voices of contemporary Israel. One of them, of the seven, is Yoel Binun. So he represents a whole face of Israel. So that's another, I'm giving you another, if you want to explore this a little more, fascinating. It's a great read. And he writes so beautifully. I mean, this is an Amazon thumbs up, 5-star review of Yosef Klein Levi, Like Dreamers, that takes seven of those guys and talks about their lives, and they represent sort of like the broad strokes of Israel. Now, so I'm focusing on one of them, Ra'yol Binyun, because of Yom Yerushalayim. So, as we mentioned, Yerushalayim of old was the center for three things. Number one, national sacrificial service, done by Aaron. Tefillah, because everybody davened. They davened facing the Mishkan, or facing the temple. And Torah, because Moshe received more Torah there. The Sanhedrin met there. And people learned there. So here's my sociological question is, how has the liberation of Jerusalem in 1967 impacted on these three areas? And if we are, if you're part of the MG Israel trip, you have an advantage. How has the liberation of Jerusalem impacted these three areas? National sacrificial service, tefillah, and Torah.
In terms of, I think, tefillah, you have, or we have, access to the Kotel now, and it's a place where people will go to daven. In terms of Torah, the Kotel and all of the Old City is just filled with yeshivot and places for people to learn Torah. And then in terms of the national service, I don't think it's within the Old City, but you have the Knesset and the Parliament, and the government of Israel is located also within Yerushalayim.
Right. So first of all, Shane, excellent points. So let me just go through. Let me unpack each one. Of course, the Kotel has had a huge impact. Within 1 week after, 1 week after the 1967 war was Shavuot back then. And, well, obviously, because we're doing the same thing now. This Thursday night will be Shavuot. So a week later was Shavuot. And they cleared out before, when they liberated, it was like a small alley, and they just moved out in 1 week, cleared out rundown housing and whatever. They made a whole plaza. And basically, like hundreds of thousands of Jews walked up on that first Shavuot, a week later, to be at the Kotel for Shavuot. Since then, millions of people go to daven at the Kotel per year. So tefillah, you know, we daven when you're in Israel. If you're in the south of Jerusalem, you daven toward the Mikdash. So you daven toward the north. If you're in the north, you daven south. If you're in the west, you daven east. If you're in the east, you daven west. It's a center point of tefillah, and that's been further reinforced. Two, Torah, as Shane eloquently said, it's not just we have a tremendous amount of institutions there, but it's also spawned creativity, because there's a phrase which you may have heard, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah. From Zion, which is another name for Jerusalem, comes Torah. So it created a revolution in learning, just like the Tanakh revolution, and much other learning. People, for example, in 1967, only a handful of people living outside of Israel would go to learn in Israel. Now, 75% of yeshiva high school graduates across North America and in Europe and South America go spend a gap year learning in yeshivot and seminaries. So create a whole revolution of variety and different kinds of learning. And in national service, we can't obviously go and do any, we can't offer a Korban Pesach, you know, on the Temple Mount because of the political circumstances and maybe some halachic reasons. But, you know, it's something that is close to us now. It's now a, it's something of consideration. There we took everybody to the Temple Institute where they're building the vessels. They built the vessels where you can actually get a sense. So the service of the Mikdash was a little more real. Before it was not even a possibility. Now, two more questions before we're going to close it up for tonight. How might have the liberation of Jerusalem motivated Rabbi Yoel Binyun to begin the Tanakh Revolution in Israel by founding Yeshiva Har Tzion and Herzog College and by teaching Tanakh with the same rigor as the study of Gemara? How much, in other words, that happened like right after 67, Okay? Yeshiva Arzion was founded, I think, in 68, 69. Herzog College was, 86 or earlier 80s. How does one thing go into the other? How did the Six-Day War, the liberation of Jerusalem, might, again with speculation on our part, have been the cause of the Tanakh Revolution? What's going on there? Can we make a link? Any thoughts?
My mind's making a connection that the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, there are so many stories about it all throughout the Tanakh that it's such a central point to Judaism, that Jews all over the world, and especially the Jews that live in Israel, and in my mind, especially those who are not religious, but those who are fighting for Israel and maybe don't know why exactly they're fighting for, because we're so many years removed from the Holocaust, that it's a reminder and a lesson, a way to teach these people who may not know, like, here's our history, here's the source for our history, here's the physical remnants of our history, and it's just an education, so the young people know what they're fighting for, and the older people will remember, and keep teaching their own kids, like, this is the importance, this is the source, and here's why it's so important, and this is what we're fighting for today.
Excellent. In other words, before 1967, and we've had classes about this before, but just to go back, does anybody know, this is a little bit of a hard question, the 3 weeks prior to the 67 war, the Six-Day War, they have a term for that. Does anybody know what that was called? Either in Hebrew or English? It was called the Hamtana, the waiting. Nasser, the head of Egypt, was threatening annihilation. He said that him and Hussein will be having lunch in Tel Aviv after throwing all the Jews into the Mediterranean. In other words, basically, the 3 weeks before the 67 war, Jews in Israel and the world were bracing themselves for a Holocaust. Because basically you had three Arab nations that openly said, if we are victorious, we're going to have a massacre. And we think that's great. And we're going to get rid of the Jewish problem. And my father tells me, this is 1967, I was only 3 months old, but basically people were scared, they were davening, saying Tehillim, it was people raising money. Basically, Israel was alone. Europe and America were not giving any real assurances they'll be there for them. And it was a dire situation. And then in 6 days, they went from being on the precipice of absolute destruction to quadrupling the size of Israel. The Golan was now in the hands of Israel. The Yudah v'Shomron, now in the hands of Israel. The Sinai and Gaza, now in the hands of Israel. It was shocking. They could not believe it. So, a sense of nationalism and a sense of personal dignity. Now, does anybody know where they do the swearing-in ceremony for new soldiers in the IDF?
This is just a guess on the Golani base?
Nope. Good guess.
Is it at the Kotel?
At the Kotel. And the guy has two things in each arm. In each hand. What is in each hand of all the soldiers?
His gun and his Tanakh.
He has a gun and he's handed a Tanakh. And while he's holding the Tanakh, and you should Google this, go on YouTube to see the ceremony, the tekes. And they have to say three times, Ani Nishba, I make an oath, a real shvua, that I'm going to protect the land of Israel. Why are they holding the Tanakh? Already, Shane already gave it away. Why are they holding the Tanakh? Because that's their history. That's their identity. That's their mission. That's their vision. So what Rabbi Yoel Binun basically did, let's take this up a notch. Because before the State of Israel, we had the full beauty of the State of Israel. The Israel of Tanakh was in Jordanian hands. Where was Yehudah v'Shamron? Where was Derech Avot? Where was the Gush? Where was Yerushalayim? It was under control of the Jordanian army. Now, the land of the Tanakh was given back to us. Well, we got to study this. It became more real. The reason why a Tanakh tour is so powerful, when you learn a story about David and Goliath, and you're standing with your Tanakh, where it occurred, I cannot articulate it, but the sense of the realness of the experience is far more powerful. And that motivates to take the full scope of modern and ancient study, history, archaeology, the Mefarshim, everything that has to do with Tanakh, and of course, looking, you know, mapping it out with the land of Israel itself, and making it one holistic whole. It was really to learn Tanakh in Israel in a deep, sophisticated way is really bonding yourself to the land of the past and the land of the future. So it's completely different. I cannot... Learning Tanakh, you're doing it on Zoom, we're in America, it's great. It's great to have a Parsha class, we learn Navi, we can learn, you know, it's good. It's all good. It's Talmud Torah. But when you're doing it in Israel, experientially, it's a far more powerful. So I want to conclude tonight with our last question. Why should we celebrate Yom Yerushalayim today? And my question to you guys personally is, what should you be thinking about this Thursday night into Friday on Yom Yerushalayim? So why should we, so I'll start off with a question. I want to hear from each of you guys. Why should we celebrate Yom Yerushalayim? It happened 53 years ago. It's a good thing. But why should we celebrate it now? Anybody want to take a stab first? Start us off. All right, Shana?
I would say Yom Yerushalayim is important as Yom HaAtzmaut. That Israel is extremely important, but having Yerushalayim is even more so important.
Why?
For everything we've talked about tonight, it's with the, well, to move on from that, it's where the Beit HaMikdash was. And even, so back then, when the temple existed, it was where the Shekhinah was. And I would 100% make the case that the Shekhinah is still there.
First of all, the Rambam says that the Shekhinah ain't a betela, that the Shekhinah in the Holy of Holies is not nullified, which means that, now I don't know what that means, because on the other one we say in our Tavening, Hamachazir Shekhinah Tzion, may God restore Shekhinah to Zion, to all of Jerusalem. But apparently now, it relates to, still there's a relationship to, and therefore there's a sanctity to, the Temple Mount. So I'm sorry, I derailed your thought. You were in a roll there, Shane. I apologize for that.
That's okay. That's my case. That it's just so important to Jews, to our history, and to Hashem, because Shana is still there.
Okay, so Shana's point is that getting back the location of the Mikdash, which still has holiness, because you're not, by the way, you're not allowed to walk around on the Temple Mount. You can walk around it, but not on it, because it still has a sanctity. It still has a Kedusha. One of the more bizarre things, one of the more troubling things is that in order to make peace with the Arabs, they gave the Temple Mount administration back to the Wafq, which is the Arab authorities of Jordan, to manage the Dome of the Rock and also the mosque. And the rule is that they made is that a Jew cannot daven there. But we just mentioned one of the major features when King Solomon talked about the Mikdash, he didn't talk about the offerings. He says it's a place to daven for all of humanity. It's a place of prayer. Not that you're closer to God, but allows you to think about God in a much more impactful fashion. Okay? Okay, that's Shane's point. All right, Shmuel, what do you say? Why should we celebrate Yom Yerushalayim today?
Because many lives were spent to take it, and it can be you could lose it tomorrow just the same.
Yeah, but from that argument, why not? But there are many places throughout the globe where many young men went to die, like in many American soldiers died in Iwo Jima in the fight against the Japanese. We don't, that's now just a desolate,
Right, but my second point and why that's so valuable is because it is a cornerstone of our identity, of who we are as a people. And it is worth remembering and protecting.
Okay. In Israel, many people say Hallel whatever people do on Yom HaTzmaut, saying Hallel, some with a bracha, some without a bracha, whole Hallel, half Hallel, since it's a day of celebration, they do the same thing on Yom Yerushalayim. Okay, Suzanne, but why should we celebrate today?
What Shana said, or what Shmuel said. This may sound crazy, but it's representative of a place where it is our place. And I have to say, I was in Israel one trip on Christmas, and this is going to sound weird, it didn't feel like Christmas, and I loved that. I felt like this is my place. This is where I belong, and it was such an amazing feeling, and that's one of the reasons I think it's so important, and it's where you can really be a Jew.
Well said. I mean, when, in a certain sense, the Jewish, obviously we don't have the temple built, which is the next step, but a sense of our Jewish homeland was further solidified, I would encourage anybody and everybody to consider Aliyah, especially if you've not yet settled your home situation. I'm not saying it's easy to make Aliyah, but there's a lot of goodness about it, and it's exactly what, for the very simple reason what Suzanne said, you're living in a country which is organized and directed by Jews. And the Jewish identity is celebrated. The Jewish year is felt. In America, we're in a country not our own. We're in a Christian, where 82% of Americans are Christian. End of December, you feel you're in a Christian land. In many ways you are, even though there's a separation of church and state. You go to Israel, December 25th, you don't feel the Christian element, and if it happens to coincide with Hanukkah, you'll feel a different celebration. You'll see on every single window a Chanukiah, thousands, and I don't care whether you keep Shabbat or don't keep Shabbat. Everybody does Hanukkah candles, and everybody's having jelly donuts. Okay, that is a universal. So those are great reasons. All right. So, Sean, what's your thoughts about why we should celebrate Yom Yerushalayim today?
Yeah, in addition to what everyone else said, just to me, Yerushalayim is like the focal point, place of the whole Judaism and like Yiddishkeit. And at least for me, when I go to Israel and like the Kotel, like the Friday night davening at the Kotel is like the best experience. For me,
I agree. I've done the Israel trip. I don't know, 12 times. I don't know, 12 times, whatever. But the best experience for me is when we, as the MG community, are on the promenade there on Yeshiva, Nativ Aryeh, and we're having our own davening, but we're looking out over the Kotel Plaza. There'll be about 10 to 20,000 people because it's the height of the summer season. And you see Jews, non-Jews, religious, not religious Jews, but there a sense of, you get a sense, you get to feel like you're a national Jew. And that gift is only because of the liberation of Jerusalem, which was beyond, again, I can't dramatize that, But if you, but psychologically, if you were a person who thought that you were going to be killed, and they made built mass, they dug out mass graves in the parks of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. It was that bad. And then now your country gets quadrupled, and you get the capital of the Jewish people, and this, and by extension the center of the world, Jerusalem. It's just simply it's just unimaginable. It's just simply unimaginable. I can't express the feeling, but if you imagine if you were there, what you could, how you feel. All right, Julie, what do you say?
I agree with everything that everyone said. I would just add that, it's important also politically. I mean, just about 2 years ago, I was actually in Israel in 2018. They declared that the embassy should be moved to Jerusalem. So it's just besides the fact that it's important because we are Jewish and what that individually means to us on a political level is very important.
100%. Yes, we got the what Julie is referring to was the shifting of the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, confirming and saying that the United States government maintains that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the state of Israel, and by extension the Jewish people. So that was a very important political affirmation of basically everything we're saying. So, so I'm just saying that I think we've talked about what to think about. I don't know if you would, before this class, you would have known that it's Yom Yerushalayim because we don't live in Israel. If you're in Israel, you can't deny it. It's throughout the entire, certainly in Jerusalem, but it's a big national celebration. And now that we go into, you know, this Thursday night into Friday, just to take a moment to reflect about literally the gift that we got, and obviously it's not, you know, we still have Tisha B'Av, it's not complete. We don't have the Mikdash, you know, as has been mentioned. Rabbi Alex Israel has a nice phrase. He says, are we waiting for the Mashiach, or is the Mashiach waiting for us? So until that point, until that waiting is over, and we get the Beit HaMikdash, or we're ready for the Beit HaMikdash, we still have to enjoy the profound gift, which is Yerushalayim. And I just wanted, that's why I wanted to introduce you to a person who was in that dramatic battle, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, who then became inspired to recreate and make and influence society positively by sharing his insight and Torah about Tanakh. And my son, just to give you a little personal story, this Thursday night, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, for the last 30, 40 years, takes a tour with the students from Yeshiva Har Tzion, step by step of his liberation as a soldier, step by step through where he went with his guys, on the way, culminating, of course, at the Kotel, and what he did, and describing the battle step by step. And that's how he shared with his students, you know, remember that freedom is not free, and guys died, and, you know, we've shared this video before, but Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, who came down there immediately once it was liberated, and the thing that he did, of course, blowing the shofar, he was holding the Sefer Torah, you saw, you know, the famous picture, but he said a Kel Mali Rachamim, which is the prayer on people who passed away, and all the guys that died to take Jerusalem, because there were lots of Jordanian snipers that killed a lot of young guys. You know, it was not a no-cost circumstance. Intense fighting, but after one day, and Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun feels miraculously, they just ran home. They retreated dramatically back to Jordan. So we have what to appreciate. God willing, we'll be able to get on a plane sometime soon. Not allowed yet, but sometime soon to be able to enter the land of Israel. Hopefully, you know, the COVID virus problems will end, and be able to return to Israel and be able to enjoy, you know, the Ir HaKodesh, the holy city of Jerusalem. and to engage in learning and tefillah and feeling a sense of Jewish identity that is only felt in the center of the world, Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh. So thank you guys for joining us tonight, and and hopefully hope you have a joyous Yom Yerushalayim Sameach.
Thank you, Robert.